I am delighted to have further expertise weigh in on the discussion of dysfunction. Dysfunction in an organisation, in a leadership team. What does that mean? What are the consequences and how do we address it once we have identified that this joint just ain't functioning as it's meant to or as I'd like to? I have with me a very special guest. Audrey McGibbon is a chartered occupational psychologist, executive coach and wellbeing expert, co-founder of Eek and Sense, which I love. I love the Eek part of it. Welcome.
Thank you, George.
Now, you've worked with people at all levels across all sorts of sectors. What are the essential leadership conditions that improve wellbeing?
Well, that's a big question to kick off.
I only do big questions. Yeah, yeah, you might get you in a little bit closer to that mic.
Thanks, George. Yeah, no worries. Thank you for the big question. Okay, so the essential leadership conditions for
a functional workplace.
Yeah. Okay, so we need to firstly talk about the relationships, the quality of the relationships in the workplace. Mm-hmm. And we know that when they're right, that serves as a really good buffer mm-hmm. for a lot of the other stuff.
Okay.
Shall we say, so that happens thereafter.
How do you build those?
Right. Okay. So that's where it gets really psychologically quite tricky because humans are primed to assess for risk and threats. And mm-hmm. so in organizations at the moment, we see a lot of insecurities, a lot of self-doubt. And when we're anything other than feeling sort of relaxed and secure in ourselves, it's not really a surprise then that we start to behave in ways that perversely push people away from us rather than draws towards us.
Yeah, so isn't that sad and interesting that people, when they act out and they stop creativity in the team that they're hoping to inspire or lead or encourage or enthuse?
Absolutely. And, you know, when it's not what people want, but it's kind of a function that, well, it's what happens to individuals when they are in an environment where they want to perform. So if most people, I subscribe to the school of thought, call me an optimist, call me naive, but
people get up and try and do a good job.
They do.
I'm
most people
too.
Are really yeah. good people. And yeah. yes, we, you know, unfortunately, we do have the corporate psychopaths and there are, you know, some bad people in this world who get perverse delight out of doing bad things. They are the tiny majority.
They're so few and far between.
And yet there is almost everyone has some experience of being, if you know, not to sound too dramatic, but psychologically injured as a consequence of some interactions from their colleagues. Now, it's not intentional. And is that because they're behaving badly or is it because you're so overtired and overwrought and anxious about your own performance that you perceive injustices or attacks on you that aren't there? And it's not really about trying to attribute blame, but it's acknowledging that that is the messiness, the glorious messiness of being a human. We're not particularly rational.
No.
And we are programmed to protect ourselves.
We like to think we're making rational decisions, but they're not. They're emotional decisions. And leaders often think feel very unsafe in the higher up the corporate ladder they go, the more visible they are. And the more, obviously, I think for most of us, with that comes fear because they're visible, they're accountable. Well, theoretically, they ought to be. And they're up for more scrutiny because they've got a salary that is commensurate with that visibility and that risk.
Yeah, that's right. So, you know, there's an assumption that if you're in the role of a leader that your well-being sort of should be higher because you get the big ticket rewards. And on paper, you are supposed to have more of what's called agency, so more autonomy. You know, you're the boss, so surely you can call the shots. Now, in the 30 years that I've been doing this, what I would observe, and it is backed up by most of the sort of aggregated research that's coming through, is there has been an increase in the magnitude of the pressures, the scope of a leader's role, the expectations that they're under. And while that accountability is going up, their mandate or their power, if you like, is shrinking because it's really residing within a tiny handful of individuals. And that is particularly true in the less functional organisations.
Yeah,
so
right.
where you, you know, on paper, you might have a structure in a large organisation with 100 senior leaders. There's probably only about 8 that really, in the informal pecking order, have the true power.
So is that like if you've got a big pay packet and a lot of visibility and a lot of responsibility but minimal power, is that a problem? Because I think some people think, oh, the pay will compensate for my lack of agency and autonomy. But is that your experience that it actually does? You can compensate somebody out of their, you know, right to be autonomous?
I think it's certainly a statement of truth that there is a lot of people on high incomes who now feel sort of somewhat trapped or backed into a corner. And it's not a sob story. Sometimes you might think, they should leave. But it's kind of the way that organizations are working.
Yeah.
There was the book years ago about the affluenza.
Oh,
yes. You know, sort of getting trapped into the trappings of, you know, my God, I don't have enough money because it means I can't have the second, you know, house.
The gilded cage.
And so I think there is this sort of tacit, implicit trading or trading off and sacrificing that says, well, here's what I think I get from doing these big jobs, and this is what I'm giving. And I think for a long time, people, if you're in a senior leadership role, you kind of go into it with an expectation that it is going to take a lot out of you. You know, you're up for it. And they tend to attract people who are highly achievement oriented, perfectionistic. And for most people, there is this desire to give and to perform and to do something well. The trouble starts when they can't do that.
Yeah.
And when you can't get agreement across it. You mentioned a minute ago that, you know, the trouble is people aren't logical and it's all about emotions. And I think what I'd love to be able to do is to sort of get the whole world thinking emotions are in fact facts. Because
they
emotions come from your chemicals in your brain.
Well, that's also what you live for. I mean, even having a big bank balance, it's just to give you a feeling.
That's
a big
exactly
house
right.
is just to give you a feeling.
That's exactly right.
You know, so you're really paying for feelings. And I think the idea that you can trivialise it, like, you are just how you feel.
And if we got better at, firstly, understanding what our own emotions and feelings really are. So when we say to people, so how are you today, George? You know, your usual response will be, yeah, no, good, okay,
good things,
busy.
How are you? Yeah.
Fine.
Yeah.
So if I do this little thing, say, okay, we have to ban those words. We're not allowed them. You're not allowed to say, okay, fine, tired, busy. Let's go a little bit deeper. And it's just amazing how many people can't retrieve the language to discuss what is happening for them at an emotional level. So sometimes I'll even start with, okay, can you just use your emojis? Because sometimes it's easier to locate
That's
an emoji
true.
Because they can't articulate it. And then we work up. So it's like a muscle. You have to go to the gym.
Yeah.
And what we find is that when you're able to acknowledge your own emotions, then you start to be able to have honest conversations with yourself about saying, well, yeah, I'm really pissed off with George because,
yeah.
you know, she did this and she did that. And I said, well, hang on a minute. Actually, what that's about is I'm feeling worried because I think she's making me look bad. So actually it's about, you know, stuff to do with me. Now, it may also be factors to do with George and George's behaviours.
But I'm not in charge of that.
I can't change George.
Yeah.
But I can start to acknowledge that what's driving me is my anxiety or my desire for the pay rise or whatever it might be.
Yeah, it's really interesting to being taught to, like, I've done this for a long time because I'm quite crazy, but I'd write a fears and resentments journal every morning and every night to flush out, try and actually figure out what, you know, am I being reactive to, am I being, you know, is my kid making me feel silly or is this, you know, what, why am I feeling the way I'm feeling? And I had to learn it in that very, I guess, structured way because like you know, you're bouncing from job to job and you're simply reacting to whether it's the traffic or the ATM that's out of order or whatever.
Yeah, stimulus response,
isn't
it? It's like something's happened, I react. So what is the process that you go through between having a thought and it triggering some sort of emotional response in you and then you reacting to it? And often we kind of skip that understanding about what is it that's prompted me to behave or speak or think or react in that way.
Yeah.
And so we come back up into why organizations dysfunctional because, you know, no woman and no man is an island, and there's lots of these little individuals with all these complicated processes going on in their brains with their own thoughts, feelings, and reactions. And we shouldn't really be surprised that it doesn't always, you know, result in us gelling and connecting in the way that we might like. So how do we teach people, not about resilience, you know, we'll maybe pick up on stuff later about the, you know, it's not about making everyone tougher in order to cope with the evils of the organization. No, you know, the organization has got a part to play in this.
Yeah, but you're not in a war. You shouldn't be having to feel like you've got to protect yourself from shells raining on your head. So what is the threat? What is threatening me? And how do I address that dysfunction? So how do you go with coaches who are very senior and often quite, I don't know, maybe dismissive of things like feelings? I'm a purely rational actor. I only look at the bottom line. And I can't believe all these staff are leaving because they're just lazy.
One of my favourite moments was working with another facilitator on a very senior leadership programme in one of the big banks. And we were discussing emotions, and one of the participants said, "Well, I just think this is nonsense. You know, I am not an emotional person. And, you know, can we just move on to get back to talking about P&Ls?" And my colleague said, "Well, it's interesting, X, that you say you're not an emotional person. I would observe at the moment you're bright red with the face in the face. I suggest right now you're experiencing something close to fury, but you have no idea that it's going on. But the rest of us can see it."
Yeah. Oh, that's brilliant.
And it was a classic moment. And so when people say they're not emotional, what they mean is they don't express it. So they might have a very, you know, the Brits would call it the stiff upper lip or high emotional regulation, which just means they don't express it. So then they push it down. So with you and your journaling at nighttime, incidentally, I would also maybe suggest do a little bit on the what's brought some joy.
And I like that as well. Yeah. I do a meditation afterwards, but I think for myself, it's, you know, being in single mum of four kids and everything, it was about how do I not go like a bull at a china shop and turn this to shit because I am reacting. I'm under the pump. I've got too many kids. I don't have enough money. You know, all those things. We have to take a break, but we'll be back with more of this because I could talk to you for 2 weeks. Do you want to go have a sleepover? Okay. George McEngrow with you on Disrupt Radio.